Good morning, everyone. We're ready to proceed with the first case, Tinnick v. Systems Division, Inc. Mr. Tobin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Tobin. I'm here on behalf of a Chapter 7 trustee, actually a successor trustee, whose name is David Leibowitz. He is the Chapter 7 trustee of an entity that is known as Technic LLC. I think for ease of clarity, maybe we can just refer to Technic as the debtor. Technic was in the business of distributing products manufactured by an affiliate company known as Technic Electronics. Technic Electronics was based in Scotland. And I've been told that what they manufactured and distributed were something called clean machines. I am not informed as to what those really are or what they do, but it has something to do with computers or electronics. The nature of the business, though, is not all that important. The nature of the case that's before the Court today is an appeal from an order that was entered by Judge Pallmeyer in the District Court that vacated a preliminary injunction that the trustee obtained before Judge Cox in an adversary proceeding initiated against SDI and continued from time to time. The injunction that was entered pursuant to 11 U.S.C. Section 105 of the Bankruptcy Code, 362, to enforce 362, and the principles espoused by this Court in Fisher v. Apostolou. That injunction basically was entered for the purpose of preserving and protecting the trustee's right to pursue insiders of the debtors under an alter ego corporate veil piercing kind
of claim.
Are
there any other creditors besides SDI involved?
Yes, Your Honor. There are two other creditors. Well, there's actually two pre-petition creditors, and there are three administrative expense creditors. The two pre-petition creditors, one is another insider of the debtor, and they have a small claim that was scheduled. The third creditor...
Doesn't look as if they had very substantial claims compared with SDI.
That's correct, Judge. SDI, without question, has a majority of the claims.
So what difference does it make who presides over the settlement?
Well, the issue is whether or not the estate had a claim, which it did under Koch Refining, to pierce the corporate veil, and if the estate has the claim, then the money would come into the bankruptcy estate and be distributed pursuant to 726 of the bankruptcy.
Yeah, but they're going to settle with SDI.
They can settle with
SDI. It's all a question of who's going to supervise the settlement.
Well, it wasn't so much who was going to supervise the settlement. We've had actually two different mediations and lots of activity concerning settlement, and the issue really wasn't who was going to supervise the settlement. It was where the money was going to go and how it was going to get distributed. To finish answering Your Honor's question, though, the third creditor of the debtor, the Chapter 7 debtor, was a tort claimant who filed a motion to modify the stay to pursue some insurance proceeds. And did not file a claim against the bankruptcy estate. So I will concede right off the bat, without question, that SDI held the majority of the unsecured debt and would have been the beneficiary of the trustee's activities. As a matter of fact, they realized that, which is why they authorized Neil Levin, their attorney, in the bankruptcy case to pursue so vigorously the insiders, both through discovery proceedings and other proceedings in the bankruptcy court, but I will get to that.
Now, who are the insiders you're talking about?
Three entities, two people, one entity. One is called Technic Holdings, Scottish company. One is Sheila Hamilton, and one is Jonathan Kennett.
Technic Holdings now has all the assets, presumably.
That's correct. That's correct, Judge. They were transferred. And I think the record is fairly clear on this, and we've got two signed documents by the insiders and the testimony of Sheila Hamilton that the debtor's assets were first transferred from the debtor after the judgment was entered, the $3.77 million judgment in the California District Court. Those assets were transferred, the debtor's assets, and those debtor's assets included accounts receivable, a trademark, a customer list, and the company's goodwill. They were transferred from the debtor to Electronics. Electronics then...
Well, of course, that's the big issue here, is how are they transferred?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully refer the court to three different items in our appendix. First is the testimony of Sheila Hamilton, taken under oath by Neil Levin, SDI's lawyer in this case. Now, to refer Your Honor to the appendix pages 33 through 42. The second document, Your Honor, that was signed, or the first document that was signed by the insiders, was a document that's described as minutes. And it's minutes of a meeting of the Technic insiders, and that's at appendix page 252. That's signed by Sheila Hamilton that describes the transfers of the debtor's assets to Technic Electronics. The third thing that
you're on. Well, the California court, as affirmed by the Federal Circuit, disagreed with that scenario, it seems to me.
I understand, Your Honor. Judge Cox found the assets.
Isn't that the, well, why don't we just accept that as res judicata and move on?
Because the trustee wasn't a party to that action. And Judge Cox found and Judge Aspin found that the assets were in fact transferred, as we had alleged, from the debtor to Electronics. Electronics then bundled them up and sent them to Holdings. The third item that I would draw Your Honor's attention to, respectfully, is the appendix. It's the insider settlement agreement that the trustee achieved after the injunction was entered.
And now, before you get into that, can you go back and deal with this Scrivener's error?
Yes.
That you say that even though five times in various pleadings you stated that Technic transferred all the assets to Electronics and then transferred the assets to Holding?
We stand by that. That's not the error. The error is our attribution of that finding to Judge Carter, and let me explain exactly how it happened. When you file a motion in the bankruptcy court, you have to attach a proposed order. The proposed order that we attach, which is included in the appendix as an exhibit to the preliminary injunction motion, had findings. The findings included that SDI had violated the automatic stay. At the conclusion of the hearing on the 26th of June, Judge Cox orally ruled from the bench that she was going to grant the injunction for a 30-day period. She also entered a minute order. Now, the order that we originally tendered to Judge Cox did not have the misattribution of this finding to Judge Carter. It didn't attribute it, actually, to anybody. When we redrafted the order, because we had to take out the findings concerning the stay violation, we transmitted that order to all the attorneys of record. And if Your Honors would refer to the appendix, page 463, you will see our letter of transmittal of that order to Judge Cox. We pointed out in that letter of transmittal that there was a discrepancy about the finding or the conclusion in paragraph N, Romanet 2. If you take a look at 463 of the appendix, you'll see that letter. That discrepancy was, oddly enough, not pointed out by SDI. It was pointed out by John Lipinski, the attorney for Technic, the debtor. We, for whatever reason, didn't understand what he was saying or didn't agree with what he was saying or didn't understand it, probably, and we submitted the order to Judge Cox. From the time we submitted to Judge Cox on June 29th, 3 days after the preliminary injunction, 3 days after the minute order was entered, until Judge Carter raised it, okay, I was unaware that we had attributed that finding. What happened is we combined two paragraphs in the original order into one paragraph in the revised order. So that's what happened. And that's the Scrivener's error was attributing the finding of the transfer to Judge Carter's opinion. We have, in writing, and I will do it now again, apologize for the error. But the error is not that the assets were transferred from the debtor to Electronics. The error was the attribution of that finding to Judge Carter. And by the way, Judge Cox and Judge Aspin's opinions both predated the opinions of Judge Carter and the Federal Circuit. Judge Carter's opinion, I don't recall the evidentiary basis he had for making the finding that he did, and I don't think the Court of Appeals referred to anything in the record either. I'm not saying that there was anything inappropriate or wrong about that. I'm just saying it wasn't there, and had those courts had the benefit of the evidence that we have here, I think they might not have made that finding. In any event, the important thing about this is not that the assets went first to electronics and then to holdings or directly to holdings. That's not the important issue. The important issue, it seems to me, is whether or not the trustee under Cope Refining had, in fact, a claim for piercing the corporate veil against the insiders of the debtor. That's what the key...
Well, you say holdings is the insider. They've got the assets.
Yes, sir.
I don't see how they could be left out of a settlement.
They weren't.
They've got the assets. That doesn't make any sense to me.
They weren't, Judge. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at the trust...
I go back to my original observation, and I'm not sure why it makes much difference who resides over the settlement as far as...
I agree with you. I don't think it matters
who gets the fees. I don't know what's at stake here. But
I agree. It doesn't matter who presides over the settlement. As a matter of fact, even after the injunction was entered, after we had the hearing before Judge Cox on the 26th, Mr. O'Connor, who represents SDI very ably, was in Hong Kong giving a speech. We talked on the telephone. I agreed I would fly out in July, July 4th or July 5th, to attend that settlement conference in California. Shortly thereafter, I get emails from his partners threatening me with sanctions. I said, enough is enough. We're just going to stay right here in Chicago and proceed along the lines that we had started. I'm sorry.
Safer.
Yes, sir. Actually, Judge Carter did invite us to come out to his court in California, and we indicated we would just as soon stay in Chicago. But that was another time. That was the hearing on September 12th. There's a transcript of that, and I would certainly hope the court would entertain
it. Depends what time of year it was.
Right? Yeah, well, I don't think any time of the year would have been very good for me in front of Judge Carter, to tell you the truth. But anyway, I did want to get back to where we were.
But before you get to that, one of the things you argue is that your efforts here are based on what's doing best for the estate. But doesn't this actually benefit, if we rule in your favor, wouldn't we benefit the wrongdoers that fraudulently transferred assets?
No, what the whole point of the injunction was to give me time to talk to and settle with the insiders, which is what I did. When we filed the injunction action, counsel for Technic, the local counsel here, Mr. Lipinski, said, we finally have somebody to talk to. Let's settle this. And I said, fine. We negotiated for several months. People came from Scotland. We talked. We entered into a written settlement agreement. You'll find in the appendix at pages A-119, and then there's a 4- or 5-page settlement agreement. They settled the estate's claims, and only the estate's claims, for $4,040,000. And we asked them to pay $30,000 up front because the estate didn't have any money. So they were going to pay an additional $4,010,000. They'd already paid $4,030,000. The condition of that settlement, not unlike many, many, many other bankruptcy cases, including Energy Co-op, was to get a permanent injunction so that SDI couldn't sue them on the same claims. The preliminary injunction that's before this court was much broader than the permanent injunction. People seem to kind of overlook that at times, but the preliminary injunction was broader. It was broad in the sense that it enjoined SDI from prosecuting any claim of any sort against any of the debtor or its affiliates. The permanent injunction, however, as set forth in the settlement agreement, was narrowly tailored to the court's standards in Energy Co-op. Your Honors may recall that was a case where there was a piercing the corporate veil claim, among others, some fraudulent conveyance claims. There was a settlement. There was Judge Koukouras was administering the case. There was an injunction entered, and it went up to the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit said, you have jurisdiction, it's fine, but your injunction is too broad, because it would enjoin individual claims that the member owners might have had against the debtor. Here, we made very clear that the injunction we wanted was only for the estate's claims. And as a matter of fact, we hired former Judge Barlings, who represented the trustee in Energy Co-op, as our expert witness, who wrote an expert report that Judge Cox would have considered, but for the fact the day before the hearing on our settlement, Judge Pallmeyer issued a stay of the proceedings. Later, she vacated the preliminary injunction, and shortly thereafter, sure enough, SDI and the insider settle around the trustee. So we are left holding the bag with no settlement whatsoever. We certainly still have claims and causes of action against Technic insiders that we intend to pursue, that are being pursued. Those claims are pending before Judge Cox.
Well, what do these claims amount to that you're talking about?
Well, there'd be the fraudulent conveyance claims for the transfer of the accounts receivable, the trademark, the customer list, the goodwill.
Part of the settlement, I assume.
No, there's no settlement with me. As a matter of fact, as soon as the preliminary injunction was vacated,
I don't know what the trustee is administering outside of SDI. You keep talking about insiders, but I don't know what that amounted to. I can't believe it amounted to very much if they were settled for $4 million with SDI.
Your Honor, there are substantial administrative expenses. Some of them were incurred by virtue of SDI's urging the trustee to do this discovery under 2004, which they used. They filed a claim in the bankruptcy estate. They submitted themselves to the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court, filed a claim for almost $3.9 million. And if Your Honors take a look at that claim, there's three parts of the claim. It's the original judgment, the interest, and then there was an attorney's fee award that Judge Carter made, not against the debtor, but against Electronics, that was also part of their claim. So they treated, for the purpose of the bankruptcy case, both Electronics and the debtor as one, at least for the purpose of that claim.
Now, Mr. Tobin, you're into your rebuttal time.
Yes, I noticed, Your Honor. Thank you. I'm going to save. I've got a lot more to say, but I'll save it for rebuttal.
All right. Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Edward O'Connor on behalf of SDI, whom I have represented in this matter since January of 2000. So I have some history with this case, and perhaps if you have questions about the background, I can respond to those. The fundamental difference between this case and the cases that Mr. Tobin and the trustee have cited is that this case involved a solvent co-defendant, which had, for all practical purposes, all of the assets involved in this case, and that's Electronics. So the case that's really controlling here is the Epson Newcoat case, and I was involved in that case, and I'm a patent lawyer, I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer. But a lot of these cases arise out of bankruptcy, because it's not at all because of a stream of liability, and it's not at all uncommon for one of the defendants who's a distributor to go into bankruptcy, leaving the manufacturer on the line, and the case Epson spells that out clearly, but it's well known, at least in patent law collection circles, that you have every right to go against the solvent co-defendant. And that's what we're doing here. And what happened was that Judge Pallmeyer, pursuant to the trustee's attempt, and let's be clear here, the trustee is not representing any other creditors, no insiders or anybody else. The only beneficiary of this action by the trustee is the trustee and the trustee's attorneys. We've dismissed our claim. It's also been settled and paid in full interest and principal.
Well, what difference does it make who presides over the settlement? You know, I can't understand what's at stake here.
Well, here's what's at stake.
The fees to the attorneys? Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. That's what we're talking
well,
about.
Well, that's what I thought, but I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, the trustees' attorneys have this collection action on a contingency. And as Judge Carter pointed out, they would stand to collect something in excess of $1 million for bringing the settlement out of Judge Carter's courtroom and into the bankruptcy court. And that was one of the reasons Judge Carter was, quite frankly, Mr. Tobin is right, and promoted him here, that Judge Carter was quite upset about that. And he felt this was an attempt to basically pull the settlement away from him. Mr. Tobin talks about the fact that they negotiated this settlement with those other parties. We'd already done that. And Judge Carter points that out in his order. We had already agreed on a settlement of full amount of principal plus interest, and we were discussing whether they were going to pay us some additional amount in attorney's fees. All of a sudden, everything got stopped. They pull it into the bankruptcy court, negotiate the exact same deal with Electronics, who was not even in the bankruptcy proceedings, and said, well, look at what we did. We scored a settlement. Now we want our million plus in attorney's fees, and there are no creditors, so SDI can get what's left. That's precisely what's happening here. So, And you know what? I would like to address the issue of the Scribner's error. That was not a Scribner's error.
And certainly the bankruptcy court's decision was based on either a Scribner's error or a misrepresentation by the trustee.
Precisely. Because if you read that complaint just on its face without knowing anything about the background of this case, what it says is there's one defendant, the bankrupt. That defendant transferred all of its assets to Electronics. Electronics then transferred all of the assets of the debtor through Electronics to the holding company, thus bankrupting Electronics. And as Judge Palmer and Judge Carter pointed out, that would mean that Electronics had no assets. So essentially the way the complaint reads on its face is one defendant, all the assets, all the other defendants were simply pass-throughs or shells. And therefore, and if that were the state of the case, they would have a legitimate claim. Absolutely. They ignored the fact there was a second defendant. The second defendant had all the assets. They have yet to identify any assets of the bankrupt except the trademark, and it's not clear in the record, but I'm clear on it because we had tried to levy on that trademark. That trademark was never owned by the bankrupt. It was owned by Electronics. Electronics transferred that trademark to Holdings. So the only assets that we know of that were ever owned by the bankrupt were, I think, a couple of chairs and maybe a computer. They listed like $80 or something in assets. They rented their building. You know, they were a non-entity. That's why we never pursued them. We pursued Electronics, and when Electronics transferred out its assets, we went after Holdings. Holdings wrote the check that eventually settled this case. So there really was no basis for this, and we do believe that that so-called Scribner's error was not a Scribner's error. We, in pleading after pleading after pleading, we pointed out that exactly what I've just told you, that why that pleading was wrong. And if you recall, in every single response, they said, oh, no, the court got it right. The facts in the preliminary injunction are accurate. And now they say, well, they didn't know. Well, I don't know how they didn't know, because I told them every time, every opportunity I had, I told them. So basically that's it, unless there are any further questions.
No questions? Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Mr. Tobin, how much time does he have?
3.5.
You know, let me talk for a minute about bringing back to the Scribner's error. The Scribner's error was an error in attribution of the finding. It wasn't an error that the assets weren't transferred. Judge Cox, in the receivership motion that was filed, had an evidentiary hearing and found that the assets, in fact, were transferred. That went up on appeal before Judge Aspin. Judge Aspin made the same finding based upon the same evidence. It is indisputable. There is nothing in this record to indicate that the assets were not transferred from the debtor to Electronics. You've got Hamilton's testimony. You've got a signed document. And then you've got the settlement agreement that was drafted in part by the insider's lawyers that described the background of the controversies. And that's in paragraph I of the settlement order. It's on the appendix A119 and 120. They agreed that the assets were transferred. Let me talk for a minute about the contingency fee issue, because that seems to be a very important thing here. When I came into the case, I wasn't the trustee's main lawyer. It was Mr. Levin, who was also representing SDI at the case. And I thought the trustee was uncomfortable, thought there was a conflict of interest, asked me to get involved. I came in, there were no assets in the estate. So no matter what arrangement I had, it was contingency. So if you're going to take the risk of having a no-asset estate and working, you might as well get the benefit of the contingency. As it turns out now, I'd be happy to do this on an hourly basis, you know, and scrap the contingency, because frankly, I'm just about there anyway, given the amount of work that's going on here. So the contingency, and by the way, Judge Cox did not approve the contingency for 5 weeks. On day one of the case, we filed a motion for the injunction. She authorized me to be retained, set her over for a hearing on 5 weeks' notice to SDI about the terms of the agreement, which, by the way, are authorized under 328 of the Bankruptcy Code. SDI didn't show up. Didn't show up to the hearing. That's what happened. And she entered, and I made clear to Judge Cox, the record is absolutely clear, that we were working on a settlement and the contingency might result in a substantial award. And she was aware that we made that clear time and time again. SDI didn't show up. So for them to complain about the contingency now, I think is hollow. And the real beneficiary of this, Your Honor, is going to be the bankruptcy process. I don't think we can have non-bankruptcy courts reign roughshod over bankruptcy judges. That's the real problem here. It's not about this case so much. It's about enforcing the automatic stay under 362. It's about respecting bankruptcy court's orders. That's what Celotex, the Supreme Court, said, that when a bankruptcy court enters an injunction, it's to be respected until it's vacated. Well, everything happened, you know, as a result of Judge Carter's order on the 12th that basically Judge Cox also found, which has not been appealed and is still a matter of record, that there was a violation of the stay by the continuation of the California proceedings. That's never been appealed. That's still before the bankruptcy judge, and that's still in the adversary proceeding. What we're asking here is that Your Honor vacate the district court order, send this back to the bankruptcy court for proceedings that are appropriate, and see who gets the $4.1 million. In the meantime, we'd like that $4.1 million in the settlement turned over to the trustee for safekeeping. That's the relief that we seek, Your Honor. I think that's the relief to which we're entitled. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Thank you, counsel, for fine oral arguments. The case will be taken under advisement.